1-800-Flowers.com is more than your birthday, anniversary, or just because gift-giving destination. We put our hearts into everything we do to help you celebrate all life's special occasions with friends and family. From our farmers and bakers, florists and makers, everything from 1-800-Flowers is made with love every step of the way, because we know that nothing is more important than delivering a smile. To learn more, visit 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST. That's 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Welcome back to Not Another Mummy Podcast with me, Alison Perry. Back in February, when there was snow on the ground and the schools were closed, blimey, that seems like a long time ago, doesn't it? Back in February, I chatted to the wonderful, inspirational Julie Brearley. Julie is the founder of Pregnant Then Screwed, a charity which exists to campaign for better rights for pregnant women and mothers. Julie tells me how her own experience of getting pregnant and then properly screwed over by her employer led her to launch the website as a safe space for women to share their stories, and how it grew into the policy-challenging campaign group it is today. Julie's book, Pregnant Then Screwed, The Truth About the Motherhood Penalty and How to Fix It, is a must-read expose of the practices and systems that force women out of their jobs because they're having or have had a baby, and about how we can challenge them and demand a fairer level playing field. Before we get to that, a quick request from me. If you enjoy the podcast, I would be so happy if you could subscribe and also leave a rating and a review on whichever podcast app or site you're listening on. Consider it a bit like leaving a tip for your waiter or hairdresser. But on to the interview. Here's Julie Brearley talking about motherhood, discrimination, and what we can do about it. Julie, welcome. I have wanted to have you on the podcast for ages, so it is so nice to have you here.
Oh, thank you very much for having me. You know, we first met about 120 years ago when I first started my Instagram account, and I had a volunteer that was working with me on Pregnant Then Screwed who introduced us, and you did a takeover, didn't you, of my Instagram account?
I did. And then I came along to your March of the Mummies.
Yeah.
Which was an amazing protest that you organised through London.
Yeah.
And I think I've interviewed you for a parenting magazine somewhere along the way. Have I imagined that?
Oh, I don't really remember that. Have you? I mean, it could have happened. My memory is awful. But it's really nice to actually properly talk to you, because I don't think we've ever had a proper chat after all these years.
And proper chats are so in limited supply right now. Like, you just really want to be able to have a cuppa and, you know, that thing of like meeting someone in a cafe and just spending a couple of hours having a chin wag. It just feels so alien right now, doesn't it?
Oh, it's so depressing. I've been lucky that we have a park very close by. So I take the kids to the park every day, and there's often a couple of mums in there that I know. So you can have a bit of a socially distanced chat. And honestly, that is such a lifesaver, even just half an hour of talking to another adult and moaning about your children. It makes the world of difference to your mental health.
And moaning about homeschooling and all the rest of this. I should explain that we're recording this in February. I'm guessing that by the time this goes out, things will have improved massively. lockdown will have finished, the schools will be back, we'll all be merrily hugging each other in the streets. What do you reckon? Do you think that's going to happen?
Oh, I mean, I reckon definitely. Absolutely. Let's think really positively. I mean, how could that not be the case? I would really hope that in March the kids are going to be back at school. I mean, as long as the kids are back at school, I think I can just about function. It's just having them at home that is the killer. As soon as I heard that they were lifting some of the restrictions in Scotland and sending the kids back to school at the end of the month, I looked at my partner and said, shall we move to Scotland? There's just no time for any break, is there? Because you've got, you know, homeschooling, caring, your work to do, the cooking, the cleaning, and you just want a bit of time away from your family.
It's really tricky because I think everyone's situation is so different in such tiny, nuanced ways. And I was chatting to a friend yesterday, for example, who her husband is like proper head down working long hours. And so she is having to kind of sacrifice doing a lot of work. She's self-employed to oversee her kids' homeschooling. And she was saying that she seems to have taken on this kind of emotional connection to her kids' homeschooling. And so if one of them has a really bad day and struggles with work, it completely, the day's a write-off for her. And she feels terrible personally. And I was listening to her and thinking, okay, I don't feel that at all, but it just really illustrates how we're all experiencing this intense situation so differently.
I don't think, though, it's helped that the pressure is ramped up a lot. So I've been hearing from mothers who've said the school has put in place sort of punishments if you're not doing your homeschooling, which is actually really quite cruel because we're all trying to do our best. And for some families, it's easier to homeschool than it is for others. And having that pressure on top of the stress and strains and anxieties of a pandemic and a lockdown is just going to make people completely crack. But mums are doing most of the homeschooling. They're doing most of the caring. They're doing most of the cooking, cleaning and ironing and all of that other stuff as well. So they inevitably are going to feel that guilt, that pressure, that strain much more intensely, I think, than their partners will do during this period.
And it's no surprise, is it really, that the mums are doing the lion's share of that work. But it's kind of interesting, isn't it? Because in some ways, the pandemic has been a bit of a leveler in that, you know, so many of us are having to work from home and, you know, there's potential to do a bit of work, a bit of housework, a bit of helping the kids with their homeschooling and then back to your work again. So it's kind of interesting that we hear so many stories of the men at their computers, heads down, cracking on with the work, and then the women scrabbling about trying to juggle a gazillion things.
Yeah, so there's really interesting data on this. The Institute of Fiscal Studies published data in May, which showed that for every hour of uninterrupted work that mothers are doing, fathers are doing 3 hours of uninterrupted work. So we know that kids, when they need something, tend to go to the mothers. And so the mothers are not being out, they're not able to do any, you know, they call it deep work, don't they? Real thinking work, because they're just always interrupted, even if the dad is meant to be looking after the kids. But the other statistic that I love quoting is that the only time the work in the home was shared was when a father had been furloughed and a mother was continuing to do her paid work. So mothers were trying to do their paid job and they were splitting all the unpaid work 50-50 with their partner, whereas their partner was just doing that 50-50 split of the unpaid work. And that's just not on, is it? It's really not fair. And inevitably, you know, this, I'm sure we'll come on to talk about this a lot, Alison, but this is having a really serious, serious impact on women's careers. And we're seeing at the moment a generational rollback in maternal employment. Women are just falling out of the workforce, left, right and centre. They've had enough, they're quitting, or they're being pushed out by their employers because they're not productive enough. They're not doing their job the way they should be doing because they've got the kids at home and they can't do their job properly with the kids at home.
We will definitely come back to that because I want to grill you on that a little bit further on. But let's kind of go back to the beginning. And for anyone who hasn't heard of Pregnant in Sixth Grade, A, what rock have you been living under? But B, you know, women have been getting pregnant and screwed for a long time. I mean, in your book, you do this great, almost like potted history of the women with the, you know, women's roles, in the workplace and in the home. But do you think, have we just got ideas above our station? This notion that we can be mothers and have a career. I mean, are we just going too far with this?
Well, firstly, it's really lovely to hear you talk about reading the book, because I think you're the first person I've had the conversation with where they've read bits of it that's outside of my immediate family or friends.
Is that kind of terrifying?
It's terrifying. Terrifying.
It's very, very good, let me tell you. It is a real page turner.
Well, thank you very much. Obviously you have to say that, but but I mean, you will know this because you've just written a book, but putting it out into the world is so frightening. You're terrified that somebody will read it and terrified that nobody will read it simultaneously. So, and it's so much of your energy, isn't it? Anyway, in answer to your question, I mean, we've used the phrase for a long time, women can have it all, or can women have it all? And what we've actually achieved from that, because we have made great strides in terms of feminism, is not that women can have it all, is that women are doing it all. So yes, they can have careers and have children, but in the process, they're killing themselves. They are working really, really long hours if you combine their paid work and their unpaid work. And they are mentally and physically exhausted in a lot of ways. And often mothers will say they don't feel like they're doing either of their jobs well. They don't feel like they're looking after their children very well. They don't feel like they're doing their paid job very well. And I did a little bit of a survey on Instagram a little while ago to ask mothers that don't work if they wanted to work, and asked mothers who do work if they wanted to give up their job. And it was really surprising. The data showed that the majority of mothers who don't work want to work, and the majority of mothers who are working don't want to work. So there's no sort of, nobody seems to have found that perfect balance where they feel that they can do both really, really well. And so we're stressed and we're stretched, and a lot needs to change in order for us all families to be happy, in order for mothers to be happy, in order for fathers to be happy, in order for children to feel completely content. There's a lot that needs to change. So that's really what the book is looking at, what we need to change.
Yeah. And you start the book by asking the question, did feminism forget motherhood? Because it kind of feels just bewildering that we have got to 2021 and this is still a massive problem.
I mean, I am often shocked at the people in the organizations that forget women have these responsibilities. And there are feminist organizations that seem to put on events that will start just as you're putting the kids to bed. And, you know, they're big feminist events. And there's a whole group of women that can't attend because they've got these responsibilities at home. We talk about the gender pay gap a lot, but very rarely do people go, oh, well, hold on a minute. Actually, the gender pay gap is caused predominantly by motherhood. We just talk about gender. And I think we've just sort of allowed this situation to persist in the name of feminism, where women are doing it all, and we haven't stepped back from that and said, okay, where have we really gone wrong here? Why is it that women struggle to have a career and have children, whereas men very happily have both? They, you know, we don't question that with men. They can have children and a career. With women, we often can't. And so I would like to see more feminists and more organizations really think a bit more about this and think about what needs to change.
Yeah. So tell me what happened when you were 4 months pregnant. Because that's where all of this, you know, your whole campaign basically stemmed from, wasn't it?
Yeah. So Before I was pregnant, I would never have called myself a feminist. It just was not a word that I used. You know, I'd lived in Newcastle for years and years. I was a northerner and felt like I was one of the lads, and I didn't need feminism. What was this feminism nonsense? It was for women who wear comfortable shoes and are a bit angry with the world. And, you know, I like to dance to drum and bass and snog men, and, you know, just didn't, it wasn't a word that I associated with. And then I was working actually for a charity, and I discovered that I was pregnant. It was a happy accident, but that's probably one for another podcast. And I waited a little while before I told my employer. I emailed her and said, okay, look, I'm pregnant. I'm going to have the baby on this date. I realize that will be before my contract ends because I was on a fixed term contract. But I have a really great plan of what we'll do. So let's have a chat about it tomorrow and we can work through how we'll manage it. And then the next day, I vividly remember I was just brushing my teeth in the bathroom and there was toothpaste everywhere, you know, and I could hear my phone ringing and I didn't answer it. And then I listened to the answer phone message and it was a message from my employer and it just said, "Hi, Jolie, I'm really sorry to have to do this, but your contract is being pulled. Could you please hand over all the work that you've done immediately?" And that was it. And the phone went dead. And so, I mean, I just remember shaking, my hands shaking, and pacing the floor up and down because I just couldn't quite compute what she'd said. But I then, as I thought about it more, became more and more terrified. I had been kicked out of my job. I was 4 months pregnant. I had my rent to pay. And without me working, there was no way we'd be able to keep our flat. There's no way we'd be able to put food on the table. And also that felt like my career was over. Any chance of a career had just been pulled from under me. So I made a few phone calls, obviously called my partner, called my mum, as you do. And then,
as you do.
And then called my partner's stepdad, who's a lawyer, and asked him what I should do and how I should deal with it. He's a property lawyer, so he had no idea. And he had to sort of painstakingly explain to me that selling houses is very different to discrimination and employment. And then I started looking for organisations that might be able to help me. I didn't even know the words pregnancy or maternity discrimination. So I was just typing into Google random words like pregnant and sacked. And anyway, I called a few organisations. There was frankly not very much use. And I ended up getting a solicitor in the end. The solicitor wrote the organisation a letter demanding I be compensated. The organisation just ignored that letter. They threw it in the bin. And so the next stage was to take them to tribunal. Did I want to take them to employment tribunal? I asked the lawyer how much that would cost. They said, well, be in the region of about £9,000. And who has £9,000 when you have just had a baby? Who has £9,000 anyway?
Yeah, just burning a hole in your pocket, you know, just there.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, nobody I know has £9,000 sitting in the bank account at any point. So I said, okay, I'll think about it. And then that week I went for an appointment, a routine hospital appointment, and they did a scan on me and they said, I'm sorry to tell you, but your cervix has almost vanished and you could go into labour at any point. And if you go into labour now, the baby will die, because I was 20 weeks pregnant. And I don't remember this next bit, but I passed out flat on the floor and was scooped up by my partner, who thankfully was there, and they put me on a hospital bed and taught me through the options. I had to have an operation so that they could try and sort of bolt my cervix together to keep the baby in place, and I had to take this different medication. And the doctor said to me, whatever you do, don't get stressed. stress is the thing that will trigger early labour. Now, of course, I'd just lost my job. And I do wonder whether losing my job had triggered this whole process, but, you know, obviously I'll never know that. But stress really, it wasn't a choice at that point. I was extremely stressed, but I did have a choice as to whether I took my employer to tribunal or not. And going through an employment tribunal is one of the most stressful things that you can do. So I decided I had no choice but to drop the case and just get on with it.
And your pregnancy ended up going fine, didn't it, after that, in terms of you went to full term and...
Yeah. I always forget to talk about that. He is a very happy, very giddy, very lively seven-year-old. A seven-year-old that told me he hates me yesterday. So that was pleasant. But, you know, that's seven.
That's just standard, isn't it? Standard seven-year-old stuff. So looking back on that, are you filled with kind of mixed emotions and feelings? Because on one hand, you must think that was definitely the right thing to do, because I've got a seven-year-old now who's able to tell me that he hates me, and that's wonderful. But on the other hand, oh, the injustice and the unfairness.
Well, that was it. That's what broke me, really, was that I had to just accept this situation. And so I had to take it easy because of the problem with my cervix. So I spent, and I didn't have a job then. I was unemployed. So I would lie on the sofa with the TV on during the day, just, you know, awful daytime telly, which never makes you feel any better about the world anyway. And I just would cry all day and rub my stomach and beg the baby to stay put, and also would be so angry that that had happened to me, and there was nothing I could do about it. I just had to literally lie there and take this discrimination.
And there's a time limit, isn't there? Or there was a time limit. I don't know if it's changed.
Yeah, it's
now.
3 months.
Where was it?
Three months less one day.
3 months you have.
Yeah. From the point the discrimination occurs, you have 3 months less one day to raise a tribunal claim.
And has that changed now?
No, that's still in
place. For some
reason
I thought it had.
No, we campaigned for the last 6 years for that to change, and we haven't got anywhere with it, unfortunately.
I mean, it's just bonkers when you think about how vulnerable and, you know, so many women just aren't in the place to be fighting that at that point, to not give them longer to be able to, you know, fight that and do something about it is just bonkers.
It really is horrendous. I mean, there's no other word for it. It takes you at least 3 months to turn the hurt and the confusion and the sadness into anger. And so the point that women go, okay, I feel ready now to do something about this, and I'm so angry, I have to do something about this, they come to us and we say, when did it happen? And inevitably we have to say, you're out of time. You can't take this case to tribunal. And that's just so deeply unfair. But also this discrimination occurs when you aren't in a place to take a case to tribunal. You're either pregnant, in which case, as we know, that sort of stress can really damage the mental health of the mother or the growth of a fetus, or you've just had a baby, in which case you can barely make a cup of tea every day, can you? I mean, so masterminding a tribunal is nigh on impossible. And so to expect women to start these legal proceedings when they really are at their most vulnerable is just one of the cruelest things, I think, about our justice system.
And why do you think that hasn't changed in the years that you've been campaigning for that to change? Have you ever been given any kind of an inkling as to why you haven't been successful?
Well, so the Conservative Party's response will be there is no evidence that the three-month time limit prevents women from accessing justice. But I have the evidence that proves that it is a barrier to justice. It's just that they haven't bothered collecting that evidence. And I would say the reason why they don't increase that time limit is because more women will bring claims, and that costs the government money for them to do that. They pay, you know, a lot of money for our justice system. And it's already, our justice system is falling over at the moment. Any claim that you bring is going to take about 3 years for it to go to tribunal because there's such a backlog of claims because there aren't enough judges. So they want to avoid doing anything that would increase the number of claims.
That's quite depressing to hear, isn't it?
Yeah.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, everyone. I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently, Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
So you launched Pregnant and Screwed off the back of all of this. So, you know, so we should say that you ended up getting another job while you were pregnant. You ended up getting another job and ended up feeling like actually you were in a better place after all of this. But then you launched the Pregnant and Screwed campaign. You took all of that anger and frustration and put it into the campaign, didn't you?
Yeah, so I did. I got a great job with a brilliant company in Manchester, and I stayed with them after my second baby. They were just fab. They were really great to work for as a working mum. But the anger stayed with me and it continued to eat away at me. And after I had Theodore, my eldest, I met other mums when I went to parent groups and started talking about what had happened to me. And I was so shocked at the number of women that told me stories of discrimination as well. Often not as obtuse as mine, shall we say, but, you know, some really harrowing stories as well. And I was just so surprised because I genuinely thought I was the only person in the world that this had happened to. I didn't think this happened commonly. I didn't read about this in papers. I didn't know that this was a thing. I just thought, you know, you have a baby, you go on maternity leave, you're protected if your employer pushes you out. But actually, the reality was very, very different. So I thought, if I don't know this is going on, other people don't know this is going on. So I know I'll start a website, I'll get people to tell their stories anonymously, and everything will change. I'll just fix it.
And was that the kind of the sum of your idea at that point? I want to start a website and share stories, and that will be enough.
Yeah, completely naively thought, as soon as people see all these stories, then the government will go, oh, this is mental. How is this
we
still happening?
We have no idea.
Yes, yeah. So we'll just sort that out and off they'll go and fix the problem. And so that was really why I did it. And it took quite a while to get the first 10 stories. I was pleading with different women to write out their stories for me so that I could post them on the website. But these women were traumatized and they didn't want to relive that trauma. But once I had the first 10 stories on there, I then got invited onto the Victoria Derbyshire show. Remember her?
Yes, it must have been very exciting.
Yeah, it was terrifying. I'd never done anything like that before, apart from a really dodgy appearance on late night. Do you remember Man O' Man?
Yes.
There used to be a show called God's Gift on Channel 4 that was on really late at night. It was on at like 11:30. And Davina McCall used to present it before anybody knew who she was.
It was that classic kind of got back from the pub, you've had a few drinks, and it's the perfect thing to put on the telly, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, yeah. And it was like a really filthy version of it where people would like lick things off each other's body. Well, I was on that when I was 16. So that was
Were you the liquor or the licky?
I did not partake in any licking. There was no licking from me at all. But I did get chatted up in a fake laundrette by a very handsome young man. But yeah, so that was my only appearance on television before then.
We're going to have to delve onto YouTube and find this clip.
Oh, I've looked, Alison. I can't find it. I have looked, but people have seen it. I've never actually even seen it, but it definitely exists. So we were invited to go on the Victoria Derbyshire show. Me and at this point, I had met a brilliant lawyer in Manchester called Danielle Ayres, and we briefly had a cup of tea and a chocolate bun in Manchester and talked about what I was trying to do. And she was an employment lawyer. So they invited her to come on it as well. And one of the women who'd sent their stories in. And yeah, it was terrifying live TV experience. And as soon as it finished, the adrenaline was so intense. I burst into tears as soon as the cameras were switched off. But that really triggered an influx of stories. So as soon as that finished, you know, my phone was going off the hook with people sending in their stories and wanting to talk about the project. And that really was the kind of the start of it all.
And you mentioned earlier on that, you know, your impression before all of this was that you had, you know, you got pregnant, you had a baby, you had a job, it was all protected by law. And that's the thing, is that this stuff is illegal. So how are employers getting away with it?
Yeah, it is illegal, and the statistics are really frightening. So we know that before the pandemic, I imagine it's got much worse since COVID-19 started, but we know that 54,000 women a year are kicked out of their job for daring to procreate. So that's 1 in 9 pregnant women will lose their job. And we know that 77% of working mums encounter some form of discrimination. And I think some employers know they can get away with it. They know that it's so difficult to do anything about that type of discrimination once it happens. They know that you're vulnerable and that you're unlikely to object to that treatment. So they feel empowered to behave in a discriminatory fashion. And that's very concerning. I also think some employers don't mean to discriminate. I think they're genuinely just a bit confused and they mean well. So there's one story that was sent to me, which I think exemplifies this really well, was a woman had been working for the same employer for 7 years. She was doing really well. Her boss said to her, look, you've done such a great job. You definitely deserve a promotion. So that promotion is in the bag, but you need to go through an interview. It's got to be a formal process, but it's definitely yours. Before the interview, she told her boss that she was pregnant. She didn't get the promotion. And when she asked him why, he said he had discussed things with his wife and they had decided that her priorities would change. And then you can sort of see that he really didn't mean any malice by that. He genuinely thought she won't be able to cope with this promotion. When she's had a baby, she'll want to focus on the baby. I don't want to put pressure on her. And it's patronizing and it's paternalistic and it's all of those things. But I can't feel that angry towards that employer because I can see why he's done that. So I think often with these cases, discrimination cases, it's really good for women to have, when they can, to have conversations with their employer and try and break down those barriers and break down those gender stereotypes that really exist and to say to them, yes, I am pregnant and yes, I'm having a baby, but I still want to, you know, I still want this. I still want to be promoted. I still want to work X number of days. And if they sense that they're being pushed out of meetings or if they're being sidelined in any way, just really try and broach that with your employer and break down those communication barriers that can exist without than meaning to, because employers just feel uncomfortable and they don't really know what to do about it when you say you're pregnant. They're sort of, they panic often. And so the result is that you are left out of these meetings and that you are ignored and sidelined. And we really do find that if women broach it, that it can really, it can make a massive difference.
So, I mean, it just feels like a huge, huge problem. What do you think the answer is? Because on one hand, you could be thinking, well, you know, I kind of feel for these employers, especially if you're a small business and if someone that you employ gets pregnant and suddenly, you know, you've got a pet from maternity and they might not come back, and it has this huge impact on your business, on your company.
Yeah.
So, you know, maybe I won't employ that woman. Maybe I'll, if I'm faced with a choice when I'm, you know, when I'm recruiting, maybe I'll give it to that bloke because he's not going to go off and get pregnant. And obviously that's ridiculous, but you can see how their thinking is. So how do you, what's the answer? Do we need to completely redesign, reshape the whole work home structure in some way?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So, there's sort of two layers there. So we need a complete change in policy and legislation, which comes from the government, to create a more equal share of caring from the outset. So a really fundamental change that we need is properly funded, ring-fenced paternity leave. And we know that if that is implemented, men will take time out of the workforce in their droves. 85% of dads want to spend more time with their children. This isn't men just shirking their responsibilities. This is about a system that just doesn't work for dads as well as not working for mums. And if you look at Scandinavia and Quebec, countries where they have ring-fenced that paternity leave and they pay it at a good rate, so about 80% of salary, then the numbers are insane of men taking really long periods of leave to look after their kids. And the result is an equal share of domestic labour, but a more equal share of domestic labour. And it also translates into women doing much better in their careers. They're much more likely to progress. They're much more likely to earn more money as a result.
So has that shift in the home, are we seeing the effect that that's having in the workplace? So, you know, is there definitely a correlation there?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there is a direct correlation between the number of weeks paternity leave that a father takes and a woman's long-term pay in the workforce. That's documented in every country across the world.
And it kind of makes so much sense, doesn't it? That if we level out the playing field so that it's not just, you know, if employers aren't viewing women as being potential pains in the backside in a few years' time when she decides she wants to have a baby, if it's a case of, well, actually, there's just as much inconvenience employing a man potentially, then surely that's got to help the situation, surely.
Yeah, that's exactly it. If you are of equal risk, then, you know, you can't just stop hiring everybody. But at the moment, women are the ones that are, in inverted commas, the risky one. The shared parental leave, of course, exists, but it's complete nonsense. It was cobbled together quickly by a Conservative Lib Dem government, and it does not work.
Has there been much uptake of it?
2% of dads use shared parental leave, which is tiny, tiny proportion of fathers, but not many men can use it or eligible for it. But also, it's so difficult to understand. I've spoken to lawyers that don't understand shared parental leave. It's just, it really doesn't make very much sense at all. But also, as a family, you lose money usually if you use the shared parental leave system rather than using maternity. So, you know, there's so many barriers to using it that's why the uptake is so low.
So as well as ring fencing paternity leave, what else needs to be done? Is there anything to be done with childcare and overhauling, you know, the system that we have there?
Yes. So our childcare system is just a mess. We have the second most expensive childcare system in the world after New Zealand. And it's We did some research on this about a year ago and found that a large proportion of mums are actually paying to go to work because the childcare costs are so high in this country. Not only is the childcare really expensive and prohibitively expensive, it's also not very good. Like, our childcare system just really isn't very good. Staff are so badly paid and not very well trained that the standard is not high and is deteriorating as the funding from the government doesn't increase. And as childcare workers, we've seen certainly through this pandemic, you know, they're desperate for more childcare workers because nobody wants to work in childcare because it's so badly paid and so overworked and such a stressful, intense job. So we want to see a childcare system that makes sense financially for families. So ideally, no more than 15% of your wage. And we need it to be really good quality. And we need it to be available because only 60% of local authorities have enough childcare for under twos. And that will get far worse by the time this pandemic is over. We're looking at losing about 25% of our nurseries during the pandemic because actually the government has reduced funding to the childcare sector over the last few months, not increased it, which is exactly what it needs to keep going. So if we had a childcare system that really worked for children and for families, then we would definitely see more mothers feel enabled to go to work. We know that there are hundreds of thousands of mothers who say they can't work because of the cost of childcare. So childcare system is a big one. We really need to fix the childcare system.
I know how that feels. I've got 2-year-old twins, and a few months ago we looked into how much it would cost to pop them into our local nursery. And it's not like a big old singing, old dancing nursery. It's pretty standard. And bearing in mind, okay, there are two of them, but if we were to put them in full time, it would cost us £52,000 a year.
Whoa!
Because it's £100 each a day. And I'm thinking, oh my goodness, even if I had one of them, that's 26 grand a year. So I've then got to potentially make sure that, you know, that I earn at least that, if not more. And it's just like, that's such an insane amount of money. And that prohibits such a huge number of people from putting their child into nursery and going back to work.
Yeah, well, this is it. It's more than the average cost of childcare is way more than the minimum wage. So those on low pay cannot afford to use and access the childcare system. But I mean, that just means that families are falling into poverty. It makes no sense to me why the government doesn't support our childcare sector. It's infrastructure, and they talk about infrastructure all the time. But when they talk about infrastructure, they're talking about buildings and railways and bridges. They're not talking about social infrastructure, the social infrastructure that really allows people to work. And childcare is such a major, major part of that. But they just see it. Childcare is this, is just this, I don't know what they see it as, really.
A slight inconvenience, like this annoyance.
Yes, this expensive annoyance, exactly. Because the people that are making the decisions don't need to worry about childcare, do they? Because they have nannies who do that. And so it just doesn't seem to have been a priority for this government. And yet we know that for every pound you spend on childcare, you get £3 back in terms of investment. So, you know, because obviously you get more people in work, and you're also, by investing in care, you're investing in jobs, you're investing in people's futures. And we know that if you have really good quality childcare, the outcomes, long-term outcomes for children are incredible, particularly children from deprived backgrounds. They really benefit from childcare, and they do much better in the education system and do much better long term. So it's an investment, it's not a cost, but the government just don't see it like that.
You've touched a couple of times on the pandemic and the effects that is having. It really has affected the entire fight for equality, hasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, there's been so much going on over the last few months. There's been so many things that we have been concerned about. But if we, you know, just talking about maternal employment, which obviously is what the book is about, it's about, you know, the gender pay gap, the motherhood pay gap. We are really seeing now a generational rollback in maternal employment. Some of the research that we have done has found that about 15% of mothers will be out of work by the time this pandemic is over. And it took us 20 years, two decades, to increase maternal employment by just 9%. So, you know, this is a big problem, and it's going to take us a really long time to fix, because of course, once mothers are out of the workforce, it's really difficult to get them back in. They have very specific needs. We need good quality, cost-effective childcare, which we don't have in this country. We need flexible working so that we can manage our personal and professional responsibilities. And only 15% of jobs are advertised as flexible. We often need to work closer to home because we want to be available for our children should they get sick, and we want to do the drop-offs and pickups. So that reduces our pool of jobs that are available to us.
And school, you know, the school day finishing at 3:30 is just massively inconvenient to anybody who works, right?
Yeah. I mean, those two things just don't gel together at all, do they? 9 to 5 at work, and then school is 9 till 3:30. Yeah, it doesn't make any sense whatsoever.
I chatted to Christine Armstrong about this, the author of Mother of All Jobs. And yeah, she was saying she thinks the answer is trying to come up with a system where the school day and the working day actually works in harmony rather than being two completely separate things.
Yeah, Christine and I have talked about this quite a lot, actually. I would like to see a 4-day working week. And there's actually a lot more appetite for a 4-day working week in the last few months. Interestingly, the pandemic seems to have triggered this revival of the notion of a 4-day working week. I think that would really solve a lot of our problems. So I think 4-day working week and the kids do 4 longer days at school. And then you've got an extra day with your children, and in addition to your 4 working days, but it also means that your days start to slot together because the kids are at school longer on those 4 days.
See, when you say 4-day working week, my brain immediately goes to, yeah, but your employer would just expect you to be answering emails on the 5th day. Would it really be a 4-day working week?
Well, we see this a lot, don't we? When often when women return to work after a period of maternity leave, they ask to work part-time. And 40% of women in this country work part-time, which is really high compared to the rest of Europe. And 4-day working week is quite a common negotiation. So often women will say, I'd love to work 3 days, and their employer will go, oh, we can't do that, but let's do 4. And what inevitably ends up happening is they actually continue to do the same job they were doing before, just for less money. And so they're trying to cram all of this work into 4 days, and then they've got the day off with their child, which they're spending on their emails or on their phone or trying to like finish a document.
Feeling guilty because they're ignoring their child, feeling guilty because they're not answering the email fast enough. I mean, it's just...
Yeah, exactly. And it's completely unfair because then you lose out on this day's pay. So I've spoken to loads of women who started off in a 4-day working week and ended up just going back to 5 and felt much better. They were actually much happier working 5 days a week because at least they were being paid for the work that they were doing. And you're much less likely to be promoted if you're working 4 days a week than if you're working 5 days a week as well. So it can often stop your career in its track. But if we all worked 4 days a week, that would be a very different scenario, because what's happening now is the UK is obsessed with presenteeism. We love it. We love forcing people to work overtime and not paying them. We were crowned the unpaid overtime capital of Europe in 2019. And I just read yesterday that our average working day has increased during lockdown from 9 hours a day to 11 hours a day. We've increased our working day by 2 hours in lockdown because we're sitting at home and we're not doing the commute. So we're using that commute time to work. And because our employers feel that they can contact us at any point in the day because, you know, our office is our home.
See, this is funny because I thought, not funny, but interesting, I guess is the better way of saying it. But I would have thought that the pandemic would have helped the fight for flexible working, because we've proved that loads of us can do our jobs from home. You know, companies have set up remote working, meetings, Zoom, I mean, all of that. But actually, it sounds like the opposite has happened, that, you know, we're working longer hours and harder than ever before.
Yeah, yeah, it's really interesting. So there are pros and cons. The pros being that, as you say, you know, women have spent decades going, please let me work from home, will you? Just give me a couple of days where I can work from home, and their employer telling them it's not possible and absolutely no chance. And then as soon as the men need it as well, because there's a pandemic, suddenly we're all working from home and it was easy to do when we've been...
Isn't that funny?
Isn't it funny? So that in itself is a little bit frustrating. I was speaking to a woman the other day who worked for a very well-known beauty company, and just before the pandemic she'd had a baby, she'd returned, she'd asked to work from home 2 days a week, it had been rejected, and she'd had to leave her job as a result, the job that she'd worked in for 12 years and had worked her way up in. And then because they said, you definitely can't work from home, that's not possible, we don't do that in this company. And then 2 weeks later the pandemic hit and all of them were working from home, so you can imagine how bitter she felt about the whole thing. So there are, you know, there are good things, that there is a benefit there, that it's been proven that home working is possible. The bad side is that, firstly, what employees are talking about now is once the pandemic is over, they're going to go to this sort of blended form of working, they keep saying. So that would be where you can go into the office if you want to, but you're also able to work from home. And that is really risky, because what will happen is mothers will work from home, disabled people will work from home, and other people will go into the office. And when you're in the office, you stand around the water cooler, you have those really important conversations that can mean you're networking, you're creating promotion opportunities. They will also be the ones sitting in the meetings, having those face-to-face conversations where decisions are made, whereas the mothers and disabled people will be at home and they'll be missing out on all those conversations. So long term, I don't actually think it's a good thing for women at all.
It's an odd reference, but it's a bit like that episode of Friends, I don't know if you've seen it, where Rachel pretends that she smokes because she realizes that her boss and her colleague, every time they go out for a cigarette break, they're like doing the deals, and she's getting, her colleague's getting all the great work and projects, and Rachel's missing out.
Yeah.
So she takes up smoking just so she can go out and have those conversations. So it's going to be like that.
I mean, this also happens anyway to mothers, because the men go to the pub, don't they, and drink pints and slap each other on the backs and have hearty conversations about, I don't know what men talk about, but they then end up having the networking conversations and the slip in work conversations that can be really, really important. Whereas, you know, mothers go home and pick little Johnny up from nursery and have to do the tea and do the bedtime. So they're missing out on those vital conversations. So it was sort of already was happening, but this potentially could make things a bit worse, which is worrying. But also, as I say, yeah, we're seeing, I thought maybe this will be the death of presenteeism when the pandemic started, because presenteeism is about bums on seats. It's about employers going, oh, well, if you're sitting at your desk, you must be doing a fantastic job, so I'll give you a promotion. And mothers tend to leave work on time. But actually, we haven't seen that. We've seen people are working longer hours. And what we've also seen is that employers have found new ways around this presenteeism obsession. So they're installing, this is crazy, Alison, their employers are installing spy software on people's laptops so that they can take photographs of you every minute to make sure you're sitting at your desk. So there are companies that sell this spy software that have said the sales have like quadrupled under lockdown, with employers wanting to spy on their employees to make sure that they're doing their jobs, which is just terrifying.
Whatever happened to trust?
It's a bit Black Mirror, isn't it?
Really Black Mirror, yeah.
Yeah, and I just find that really disturbing, and it just shows how obsessive we are about this presenteeism, this input rather than output. You know, if you are sitting at your desk, then you must be doing your job. It doesn't matter what you're producing. We're not interested in what you're producing. We just want to know you're sitting at your desk, which is such a weird thing.
Thing is, I can spend 2 hours sitting at my computer and I'm just scrolling Twitter, you know.
Yeah.
I'm not actually doing anything.
Well, your concentration span is 42 minutes. So if you're sitting at your desk longer than 42 minutes, then yeah, you're just dicking about on Facebook, aren't you?
Oh my goodness. That's eye-opening and terrifying. It really is. My next question for you though, Julie, is how do you stop your stress levels from being permanently sky high? Because just reading your book, I found myself getting more and more furious.
A lot of alcohol. I shouldn't say that, should I? Yeah, I mean, I am angry and that motivates me a lot and gives me energy that I really genuinely want to change this, because I've seen it impact so many women. And obviously I have my own experience of it. And so I'm really motivated to do everything I can to try and fix the problem. What's particularly hard is dealing with the trauma. And I had there was trauma that I was dealing with before the pandemic, you know, people who have lost their jobs, who are severely depressed, they have really bad depression and issues as a result of it. And some of the messages we get are really harrowing. But since the pandemic has started, the trauma has gone through the roof. And, not just losing your job and being depressed, but, you know, women have died. Pregnant women have died during this pandemic. And that...
You've been doing a lot of work around the maternity discrimination around since the pandemic started, haven't you?
Yeah, we've focused really on the safety of pregnant women, which I feel so strongly about, and I'm still so furious about that it's not been fixed, and we're almost a year in. So we've done a lot of work around that, and then obviously we've looked at redundancies with the childcare sector, have been really key focuses for us. But when the pandemic first hit, and pregnant women were placed in that vulnerable category on the 16th of March, no further information was given about what that meant. So Chris Whitty said, pregnant women are in the vulnerable category. There's no evidence that COVID will affect pregnant women any more than it would other women, but we're doing this as a precautionary measure. And that was it. That's all he said. And there was no information about should they be going to work? Should they be completely isolating?
A lot of pregnant women at that point were, they did isolate, didn't they?
Yeah, there were, yeah, because I suppose the heightened anxiety when it first hit meant that many employees were quite good and they did suspend pregnant women and say, okay, well, you shouldn't be coming into work. You know, we're worried about your safety. But lots of pregnant women continued to work. And because they didn't know what they were meant to be doing, and we didn't know what they were meant to be doing at this point. We had no, you know, we had to then interpret this statement and try and interpret it into employment law. So nobody knew what the answer was and how to help these women. And it was really one of the most distressing things I've ever, ever dealt with. And I was just inundated constantly. My phone was going constantly. Emails were going off the hook. Our advice line was going mad with desperate, anxious women. And we couldn't give them an answer. And we managed to, in the end, we figured it out. We got the information out as quickly as we could. And then we lobbied hard for pregnant women to be kept safe. But it, you know, there was the death of Mary Aguiwapong, who was the 28-year-old nurse who died and was pregnant, and her daughter Mary is okay. But that was so harrowing. Because we had been working so hard for that not to happen, and then it happened, and I think it broke me and a few members of the team when that happened. I'm now really good friends with her husband, Ernest, and we campaign together. He works with us on the campaign trail, so stress levels. I mean, I think as well when you have kids, you sort of you can be really stressed at work, but then you have to just switch off, don't you, for a period of time and become a mum. And that helps in a way. What is really hard is the trauma of these personal stories. And I don't know what the answer is to deal with that besides having a good crying. And I have a few glasses of wine.
Sounds like you need a good therapist. It sounds like you need something in place which helps you offload it and stop it from affecting you, I guess.
Yeah, probably do.
But then in a way you need it to affect you a little bit, because that's, that's what drives you, I guess.
Well, yeah, I mean, exactly. I think anybody who works in campaigning spends a lot of time very angry. And yeah, you just sort of have to be to keep going, because otherwise you just feel like you're bashing your head against a brick wall. I mean, alongside that, I get so many lovely messages from people who we've helped, and that motivates you as well. You know, when somebody contacts me and says, I've been suspended from work and you gave me the information that I needed in order for that to happen and now I feel safe again. Or somebody says, I managed to get my job back because of the information the advice line gave me. Or, you know, we did some work around the vaccine recently and lots of breastfeeding women have said that they felt empowered with the right information when they were making a decision about whether they were to take the vaccine or not. You know, all that sort of stuff makes you think we're changing things, we're doing some good, and that's also motivating.
Good, definitely. You mentioned the advice line a couple of times. If someone's listening and they've experienced discrimination from their employer, or they're, you know, a bit concerned and not sure if what they've experienced is discrimination, is the advice line the best place for them to go?
It is, yeah. And let me see if I can remember the number, because I get this wrong sometimes. 0161 222 9879. I hope that's right.
I'll double check it and I'll put it in the episode notes.
Thank you. You know, I only remember my own phone number. You know, when you were younger, you used to remember everybody's phone number, and it's just, I don't have that box in my brain anymore.
It's like our brains have completely changed the way that we, you know, the kind of skills that we have and the things that we can do, because yeah, you're right. I don't think any of us can remember phone numbers anymore. No. We don't need to. So why should we? Jolie, to finish up our chat, your book, Pregnant Then Screwed, is available now. And where can we find you online if we want to hear more from you?
So I am on Instagram, Pregnant Then Screwed, Facebook, which is I'm just under maternity discrimination. They wouldn't let me have Pregnant Then Screwed on Facebook. I think they probably thought it was some sort of porn site. Or I'm on Twitter, at Pregnant Screwed, and then we've got a website which is just pregnantthenscrewed.com.
Brilliant. Thank you so much for joining me today. It has been fantastic to chat to you.
You're welcome. Yeah, you too. It was lovely, Alison. Thank you for having me on.
One-800-Flowers.com is more than your birthday, anniversary, or just because gift-giving destination. We put our hearts into everything we do to help you celebrate all life's special occasions with friends and family. From our farmers and bakers, florists and makers, everything from 1-800-Flowers is made with love every step of the way, because we know that nothing is more important than delivering a smile. To learn more, visit 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST. That's 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.